This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McKee. U.S. federal officials say that there are now 5 confirmed cases of new China-based coronavirus, and they expect more. The head of the Centers for Disease Control Respiratory Disease Office, Nancy Messonnier, says that all 5 victims had a direct contact with others in Wuhan, the Chinese city where the disease is believed to have started. All 5 are said to be in good condition, but are isolated in hospitals as doctors and health officials trying to find out more about the virus. The CDC says it is investigating about 100 suspected cases in 26 states. Chinese officials say 56 people have died and nearly 2,000 others in China have been infected. President Xi Jinping said China is facing a grave situation and experts and other resources would be concentrated at specific hospitals to treat severe cases of that illness. A video has emerged of a 2018 dinner at which U.S. President Trump appears to call for then-ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, to be removed. Reuters' David Doyle.
It's April the 30th, 2018, and halfway through a dinner at the Trump Hotel, the U.S. president can be heard appearing to give the order to remove the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch.
Get rid of her.
Hooray.
Get her out tomorrow. I don't care. Get her out tomorrow. Take her out. Okay?
A video of the meeting emerged on Saturday and was obtained by Reuters from Joseph Bondi, the attorney for Lev Parnas. He's the former associate of Donald Trump's lawyer Rudy Giuliani and has been providing evidence to Democrats as a part of the president's impeachment trial in the Senate. Trump has said he had the right to fire Yovanovitch, a main figure in the series of events that led to his impeachment.
That's Reuters' David Doyle reporting. This is VOA News. Rescuers continue to desperately look for survivors in eastern Turkey in the rubble of collapsed buildings after a powerful earthquake claimed at least 38 lives. Nearly 4,000 rescue workers combed through debris and freezing temperatures helped by mechanical diggers. Turkish authorities say rescue workers have so far saved about 45 people. There was more violence in Syria. In northern Syria, a car bomb killed 7. This is the World Food Program reports it's scaling up its operation to provide emergency food to tens of thousands of people in Syria's war-torn province of Idlib. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA.
Humanitarian officials say conditions for some 3 million civilians in Idlib have become intolerable since Syria and its Russian allies launched a major offensive in mid-December to seize this last rebel stronghold. Since then, the United Nations reports more than 300,000 people, 80% of them women and children, have fled their homes in a desperate bid to protect themselves from heavy bombing and shelling. The United Nations reports more than 8 years of brutal civil conflict has pushed millions of Syrians into hunger and poverty. It reports the war has displaced more than 6 million people within the country and created a food crisis for more than 7 million who suffer from chronic food shortages. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Australia Day celebrations on Sunday were clouded by the tragedy of bushfires that burnt across the country. Edward Barron with Reuters.
Australia Day celebrations on Sunday saw thousands of people flock to Sydney Harbour and Indigenous ceremonies. But festivities were clouded by the tragedy of bushfires that had burnt across the country. Several members from the New South Wales Rural Fire Service were also thanked for their work by the state's Governor Margaret Beasley on board the HMAS Canberra. Fires across Australia's bushland have scorched an area nearly the size of Greece since early October, killing 33 people, including several firefighters and volunteers, and millions of animals.
The latest program from the makers of Sesame Street is an effort to help children suffering as a result of the Syrian civil war. Sesame Workshop, the nonprofit educational organization behind Sesame Street, has launched a new locally produced Arabic TV program for the hundreds of thousands of children dealing with displacement in Syria, Iraq, Jordan, and Lebanon. More at VOAnews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, January 27th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Burundi's ruling party has chosen a successor to President Pierre Nkurunziza.
My reaction is very simple. I'm very satisfied by the way things were conducted. First of all, the man comes from the party. He has been the general secretary of the party.
Diomede Misigaro is a Burundian who lives in the U.S. city of Nashville. But some critics say nothing meaningful will change in Burundi unless the Arusha Accord is fully restored. Zimbabweans living in Botswana who cannot afford to buy new passports in hard currency can go home to do so in local currency. And Togo's opposition will for the first time field a single candidate during the February 22nd presidential election.
We want to go to this election because we decided that we will seize any opportunity that we have to fight and try to change the current situation.
Bridget Ajamagbo is a coordinator of a coalition of 14 opposition political parties in Togo. We'll have a report of low-cost invasion in East Africa, and a Malawi court ordered schools to allow dreadlock students. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's post are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Burundi's ruling CNDD-FDD party has chosen Major General Evariste Ndayishimiye to succeed President Pierre Nkurunziza as the party's flag bearer in the May 2020 election. He was elected Sunday at the party's national convention. General Ndayishimiye was serving as the ruling party's secretary general. He said he will work for the development of all Burundians. Diomede Misigaro is a Burundian who lives in the U.S. city of Nashville, Tennessee.
I'm very satisfied by the way things were conducted. First of all, the man comes from the party. He has been the general secretary of the party, and his victory was seen for a while on the ground, even if nobody knew who was going to take over. But yesterday, he showed, first of all, the maturity of the party, how all of them came together to nominate him as the man who is going to represent the whole party to the upcoming election. Now, for those who have been for a while trying to destabilize the regime in many, many ways, now they have seen that the party is strong enough. And I think after this election, the party comes with a win, a must win to the next election.
You said for those who have been trying to destabilize Burundi, but there have been allegations of human rights abuses against President Nkurunziza's government, especially when people said he changed the constitution to run for a third term.
Well, this was not proven to be true because the court in Arusha has cleared him, stating that he has the right to the last mandate that he ran for the past 5 years. Now that we have alternatives, those who have been trying to destabilize the country, as I say, what are they going to say again? Because now it seems that the so-called guy who didn't want to let somebody else take over is gone. He has given to somebody else.
What do you make of the package that the legislature gave to President Nkurunziza? The package included where they referred to the president as paramount leader, an eternal supreme guide. Some people say these titles mean that Nkurunziza will continue to have the influence in the CNDD-FDD.
Probably that would be nice if you ask that question to the parliament that make that decision. But what I can say, I have seen also in the other countries, when a president successfully is replaced by somebody else, he continues to be active in the party. He's not retiring, and he has told everybody that I will be stepping out, but I'm going to keep working for my party and for my population. I don't think it will be a wise move to say, hey, go away. You don't have anything to say on Burundi.
Thank you very much again for talking with us.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Diomede Misigaro is a Burundian who lives in the U.S. city of Nashville in Tennessee. Some critics say nothing meaningful will change in Burundi unless the Arusha Accord is fully restored. The Arusha Agreement was a transitional peace treaty signed in Arusha, Tanzania, to end the Burundian civil war. Innocent Muhoozi is a Burundian journalist who now lives in exile in neighboring Rwanda. He was forced into exile after his government shut down his station.
It's a non-event for us because nothing will change. They will win the election because they will do anything so that they can stay in power. Secondly, and most important, nothing will change because they will not restore the Arusha Peace Agreement and the constitution that result from this agreement. And this is the main point of the crisis that Burundi is in since 2015.
You refer to the Arusha Accord. President Nkurunziza has said that, according to his understanding of the Arusha Accord, his first presidency was not an election.
You know, they already changed the constitution from this Arusha agreement. And then after this, what is fundamental? They destroy all the balances that were installed by the Arusha agreement in the defense corps, in the government, in all the institutions. So there is no chance, no special chance. They cannot restore this agreement because if they restore it, it will mean that all the things that they have been doing since that time, they rejected them. No one has that power inside the system to make a kind of rewind and bring the country to this Arusha agreement.
I was talking to a Burundian friend of mine, and he said that, I think General Ndishimiye is the hope for Burundi because he can do more to bring about understanding among Burundians.
You know, it's not about a person, the way he thinks or not. People have to understand where this crisis is coming from, is this process of destruction of this Arusha agreement and the constitution that came from it. As long as we don't have a restoration of that, no matter who is the president, the first vice president, and so, no matter who are those people, the fundamental base that you can build, that understanding between Burundi as we look at it.
There was a package the ruling party made for President Nkurunziza. In that package, they still referred to President Nkurunziza as a paramount leader and also the eternal supreme guide. What do you make of that?
You know, even Mr. Ndayishimiye, in his speech, that he will stay under the guidance of Mr. Nkurunziza. This is one. Second, they give him, and then all the former presidents who were Tutsi, they are nothing now. So that means there is a clear political will to deepen the divisions between Burundians on the ethnic basis.
Innocent Muhoozi is a Burundian journalist who now lives in exile in neighboring Rwanda. You are speaking with us from Kigali. The coalition of 14 political parties in Togo has for the first time chosen a single candidate to take on incumbent President Faure Gnassingbé, who is seeking another term during the country's February 22nd presidential election. Bridget Ajimakpo, coordinator of the coalition of 14 opposition political parties, says the opposition has chosen former Prime Minister Abayomi Kojo as their candidate.
We are organizing for it not because the conditions are good for this election, not because we believe that the regime is willing to organize a free and fair and transparent election. We want to go to this election because we decided that we will seize any opportunity that we have to fight and try to change the current situation. We are going to the election, but the idea is to make all the opposition party organized to nominate just one candidate that everybody will support.
Madam, how did you come up with this decision to have one candidate now?
What we are doing now is trying to discuss with the other five candidates to join us so that they don't go on an individual basis. The main reason for this, as I said, is that Togo is not yet in democracy.
You said that you are working with what, a retired bishop? Can you tell us more about this bishop?
Yes, we are working with a retired bishop who is encouraging us to come together to organize for one candidate. And in order to allow everybody to accept the choice, we said, okay, you as a moral authority, as a religious, help us to nominate this candidate. And this is what he did. And this candidate is Mr. Agbayomi Kojo. And I can tell you that with this candidate, it will be the first time that the opposition will support at a presidential election one candidate who used to work with the regime. He has worked with the regime. He has been a prime minister, and he has been at the National Assembly.
Madam, sometime last year, the government decided that it was going to register Togolese in the diaspora to vote. What do you think about the process?
Yes, we think that the right of the Togolese diaspora to vote, and you know that it was part of our demand. And finally, they accepted, but the way they registered the diaspora members was not good at all. But we are asking ourselves, is this a reason to say we are not going and let them go alone? We want to go and fight and have our victory.
Bridget Ajamagbo is a coordinator of a coalition of 14 opposition political parties in Togo. She was speaking with us from the capital, Lomé. Today is Monday, January 27, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. Zimbabweans in the diaspora who cannot afford to apply for a new passport in hard currency have been urged to travel home to process their documents. The Zimbabwe government charges its citizens in the diaspora $318 for a new passport. And low-income earners in Botswana say this is beyond their reach. Kundisi Dube reports from Habaruni.
Most Zimbabweans in Botswana survive on low-income jobs like farm or housework and say they cannot afford to pay $318 for a new passport. Zimbabwe's ambassador to Botswana, Badirai Mkonoeshuro, recently asked his government to introduce different pricing tiers for passports. He says this could help the low-income earners who cannot afford to pay the new application fee.
So we are making representatives through our Ministry of Foreign Affairs and International Trade to the Registrar General's Office and Home Affairs to say, can they also cater for the other lower tier diasporans who can afford passports at a lower rate, even if they are to be charged in US dollars?
The Zimbabwean government, however, this week said if its national outside the country cannot afford to pay the US dollar fee, they are free to travel home. In Zimbabwe, passport fees are in the local bond notes. But some Zimbabweans, like Mary Mutiniri, who works as a health helper in Botswana, say it is still costly to travel.
If our government says we must travel back home, do they really consider the cost and the distance that we have to travel? In any case, we have to be away from work for days, as it takes time to process a passport in Zimbabwe. It's not a one-day process.
Some of the immigrants say reducing the fees at embassies is the solution. But Harare authorities argue the country needs the foreign currency to procure the material used to print passports. Ambassador Mkonoeshuro says since the process of getting a new passport in Zimbabwe is cumbersome, travelers should be allowed to use temporary travel documents in the meantime. It takes up to a year to get a new passport in Zimbabwe.
We are also talking with the authorities to say because of the challenges at the RG's office, can they accept the temporary travel documents, or TTDs, for people to travel in and out whilst they are waiting for the processing of their passports?
Without passports, hundreds of Zimbabweans continue to illegally cross into Botswana in search of employment. The neighboring country deports more than 1,000 Zimbabweans who enter illegally every month. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Habaruni, Botswana.
Desert locust has become hazardous on plantations in at least 11 counties of Kenya, as the locust invasion is likely to affect neighboring Uganda, Ethiopia, and South Sudan. Speaking in Nairobi, the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization Assistant Director General and Regional Representative for Africa, Buka Tijani, said the desert locust raid continues to threaten food security and livelihoods in the East African region. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi.
According to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, the desert locusts are said to have migrated from Yemen to the East African region. Bukar Tijani, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization Assistant Director General, said that the locusts have invaded the region due to climate change.
And to say the least, these cyclones brought in moisture conditions, which are very, very excellent for the breeding of locusts. And this is why this has started. But what we are doing now is to take an early action so that we don't go into a major disaster of an already vulnerable region, which is the Eastern African region here, because of these droughts as well as the floods that we have.
Mr. Tijani says IGAD member states and other financial institutions should come together to save the situation that is threatening livelihoods.
I'm calling on partners, both country as well as other development, as well as contributing financial partners to support this so that we can actually avert any threats to food security livelihoods in the coming months.
Six out of the nine regional IGAD member states are affected by the desert locust. Director of IGAD's Climate Predictions and Application Center, Guleid Artan, said that there is a likelihood of the locust to attack the whole region in the coming months.
The winds are going from north to south right now. So as you can see, the outbreaks that are in Sudan, definitely they will be in South Sudan. The outbreak is in Western Kenya, Uganda. Luckily, the outbreak has happened in December and January when most of the crops for the October, November, December had maturation. But this outbreak has an effect on pastoral area that have seen below average rainfalls for the last 3 years, except this season.
The insects in Kenya are now reported to be moving towards the Rift Valley region of Kenya in the counties of Baringo and Turkana. Kenya needs at least $3 million to avert the situation. The Desert Locust Control Organization says the risk of spread to three remaining IGAD member states is very high, given the limited control activities in some countries, as well as high mobility and reproductive potential of the locust. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, Yamorino Jiombo in Nairobi, Kenya.
A Malawian high court has ordered public schools to accept students with dreadlocks after an 8-year-old girl was barred from class because of her hair. The Blantyre Girls Primary School in September said the girl would have to cut her hair in line with school policies or she would not be allowed in class. The court said banning students over their hair was denying them their right to education. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Rastafarian Fenia Mbewe was upset when the Blantyre Girls Primary School refused to enroll her daughter, Makeda Mbewe, because of her hair. The school said the girl's dreadlocks were against a policy requiring students to have their hair shortly trimmed. So Mbewe took the school to court and won. Malawi's High Court this month ordered all public schools to allow students with dreadlocks. She says, "We are very much excited because in this battle, we were not fighting for Makeda alone, but all other children who are turned back from school. The problem was widespread." Malawi's High Court also ordered the school to give Mbewe extra classes to make up for those she missed. Rastafarianism is an Abrahamic religion from Jamaica that stresses living what they regard as naturally, including with hair. Jennifer Pomea is the chairman for Rastafarians in southern Malawi.
In our religion, they say every Rasta have to keep dreadlocks. When you go to the number 6 in the book of the Bible, the number 6 says, if you want to work full-time the works of the Most High as a Nazarite, you have to keep your dreadlocks, you have to keep your hair grow.
Malawi's Rastafarians have long been sidelined by education policy requiring students to cut their hair to promote uniformity in school. Some Rastafarian parents chose private schools, while others, like Deborah Habakuk, gave in and cut their children's dreadlocks. She says, "When I took my children to a public school, they refused to enroll them until they cut their dreadlocks. I tried to find an alternative, but I failed. So instead, I trimmed their hair so that they should get an education. The High Court ruling means Rastafarian parents will no longer have to choose between their religious practice or sending their children to public school. Malawi's education authorities refused to talk to a reporter on the matter and have until February 4 to appeal the High Court's order. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
Daybreak Africa's posting. Here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, James. We begin the sports on a rather sad note as NBA legend Kobe Bryant died on Sunday when a helicopter he was traveling in crashed and burst into flames in foggy conditions in suburban Los Angeles, killing all nine people on board and plunging the sports world into mourning. The 41-year-old Kobe Bryant was traveling with his 13-year-old daughter, Gianna, and seven other passengers and crew when their Sikorsky S-76 helicopter slammed into a rugged hillside in Calabasas, west of Los Angeles. There were no survivors. Kobe Bryant, a five-time NBA champion and two-time Olympic gold medalist, is widely regarded as one of the greatest basketball players in history, an iconic figure who became one of the faces of his sport during a glittering two-decade career with the Los Angeles Lakers. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, the NBA all-time leader in points scored, paid glowing tribute to Kobe Bryant.
It's very difficult for me to put in words how I feel about the loss of Kobe Bryant. Kobe was an incredible family man. He loved his wife and daughters. He was an incredible athlete and a leader in a lot of ways. He inspired a whole generation of young athletes. He was one of the first ones to leave high school and come to the NBA and do so well, dominating the game and becoming one of the best scorers that the Los Angeles Lakers has ever seen.
Atlanta Hawks head coach Lloyd Pierce reacted to the passing of NBA legend Kobe Bryant prior to Sunday's game against the Washington Wizards.
There's just certain things you don't get over. Today, that day, I never had a personal relationship with Kobe. He's spoken to me a bunch of times, and he's always told me he respects me and he respects the work that I've done, and he's watched me from afar as a head coach and as an assistant. But I've always respected his greatness because of his detail, his passion, and the intensity of which he plays.
In football news, holders Osporans of Tunisia drew 2-2 with Raja Casablanca on Saturday as both clubs booked their places in the quarterfinals of the African Champions League. Zamalek also qualified for the CAF Champions League quarterfinals following their goalless draw against TP Mazembe on Friday to raise their tally to 8 points after 5 games played, 3 points behind TP Mazembe, who have also qualified. Wydad Casablanca's 3-1 win over Algeria's USM Alger on Friday night was enough for them to qualify from Group C, along with South Africa's Mamelodi Sundowns, who drew 2-2 with Petro Atletico on Saturday in Angola. ZESCO United drew 1-1 against Primeiro do Agosto on Saturday to end their hopes of qualification for the knockout stages. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that is it for this Monday, January 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post-editor Samson O'Malley, I am Jen Butte in Washington, hoping that you have a productive week.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Today Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.